kind of why it's generic and bland. I could have said on stuff and things with applications in effective field theory, but I thought this might be slightly more descriptive. So I also have the luxury of being the first person to actually talk about effective field theory in the workshop. So I'm going to start with that and give a very brief, very brief introduction to effective field theory, mostly in the form of just stating what it is. Because I think many of you know formalism by now, if not how to compute with it, at least what it is. And if you don't, well, I think you'll pick it up as we go along throughout the workshop. So here's an overview. So first I want to talk about briefly what effective field theory is and what you do to build one. And then I want to talk about something that I've been thinking about for a couple years. And that is that, in many systems, there's some form of dissipation. Either there's friction, viscous fluid flows, energy leaving via gravitational waves, and so on. And at least within the effective field theory approach, where one wants to use an action or a Hamiltonian or so on, this becomes a bit problematic because, as is infamously known, Hamiltonians, Lagrangians, and actions don't describe dissipative systems. So I want to talk about sort of this shortcoming of Hamilton's principle of extremal action, and then talk about how one can actually improve it so that it can describe dissipative systems. And then lastly, I'll talk about how this has been applied to some applications in effective field theory. Okay, so what is effective field theory? Well, it's essentially a paradigm or a way of approaching a problem that exploits a separation in scales. Separation in scales could be, say, some small and large length scales, slow and fast velocities, high and low masses, whatever it is. Depends on the problem. And it's a way of parameterizing the effect of the microphysics, if you like, on the macrophysics. And this usually involves several steps. Namely, building an effective field theory usually involves several steps. One is you first identify the relevant degrees of freedom. If you can't do that, you don't know how to get any further, right? And along with that, you can identify the symmetries that's associated with them. For example, if you want to describe some extended system by a point particle, you know that one symmetry that you ought to have is that it shouldn't matter how you decide to parameterize the clock on the world line. So you have reparameterization invariance that goes along with that variable. Another step, well, the second step, is once you know the degrees of freedom and their symmetries, you can then just start to describe, write down sort of the general action that's consistent with these symmetries. This gives a sort of model-independent way, if you like, of describing the system. And it corresponds to more or less a derivative expansion, where the expansion is in powers of the ratios of the small to large length scales, or mass scales, or velocity, whatever it is in the problem. Now, the third step involves sort of a matching to some specific theory. For example, matching the quadrupole moments to a post-Newtonian binary in spiral, for example, to get the quadrupole moment of some effective theory describing the composite body that accounts for the binary. And I guess we'll talk about that more later. But you can match to a specific theory to get the coefficients that one adds in added into the general action by matching to a specific theory to some model, or just leaving them unspecified so that you can fit the data. And lastly, you want to compute stuff with the effective field theory. Again, it depends on the questions you're interested in, so that's why I say stuff. Okay, so what's been done with EFT? So this is kind of a feel-good slide that the community should feel happy about. So I guess it's quite amazing that since I guess this started, 2004, 2006? Well, I guess the paper first came out in 2004, but it didn't get published until 2006. So what is that? About 6 or 7 years. The community has gone really quite far, at least in terms of building post-Newtonian expressions for potentials and orbital dynamics and waveforms and so on. Over the past 7 years. It's really quite amazing. And a lot of these people here are in this room, and I think it's a success of the formalism that so much has been done.
You mentioned the absorption.
There's white space on there. So I think it's quite a success of the formalism that within the span of 7 years, all this has been done. And I don't think it's a fair comparison to say, compared to more traditional methods based on asymptotic expansions and so on, because there have been different motivations. But still, quite a lot of work has been done very quickly. And I think it's a remarkable success of the formalism. But one doesn't have to look just at the n-spirals of compact binary objects. This method has been applied to many other fields, including, for example, one of the more recent applications is via computing the tidal Love numbers for a black hole, as well as, for example, your absorptive effects, right there. Much work has been done, even outside the context of compact binaries, including cosmological perturbation theory, inflation, even hydrodynamics and condensed matter. Now, yeah, well. I don't mention this. Yeah, it's amazing. This work, this method has been applied even in particle physics. It's amazing. So I think it's really quite a successful enterprise, and it's kind of encouraging to see that some of the people have grasped this whole program and applied it to their own fields and others. All right, so that's the feel-good slide. So that means all the other ones are not feel-good slides. Okay, so I want to talk about something that maybe is not so feel-good, at least initially. And this is a misleading title, I should say. So let's imagine for a moment that you use an effective field theory to describe, say, the motion of a charged particle an accelerated charged particle. And you know that if it's accelerated, it emits radiation, and it loses energy in the process, and that loss of energy manifests in the form of a radiation reaction, which is proportional to the time derivative of the acceleration, at least 4.8. Now, if you compute what's called the effective action, and that is, so the effective action is merely this. You take the action for a point charge coupled to an electromagnetic vector field. You solve for the vector field, okay, given some boundary conditions or initial conditions, whatever, and then plug that solution back into the action that you started with. That gives you the effective action, which depends only on then the world line. And if you do that, you come up with an expression that looks like this. So the point particle term plus this thing, which if you integrate by parts would give you a z alpha a dot. And a dot looks a lot like radiation reaction, so this is great. Problem is that's zero, because that term there is proportional to the total time derivative. So it doesn't contribute to the equations of motion. Okay, well that's electrodynamics. What if we do the gravity? Well, okay, so if you compute the effective action here, I'm not going to talk about the underlying theory, but just if you do it. What you find is that you get lower order conservative Pn terms, like the 1pn, 2pn, et cetera, plus this 2.5pn term, the first term that comes due to radiation reaction from the emission of gravitational waves. And this goes like qij times the fifth derivative of qij. Now this is great because the fifth derivative of qij looks a lot like the Birk-Thorne radiation reaction force. But again, if you take two time if you do two integration by parts here, you get a q double dot, q triple dot, and that thing is again proportional to a total time derivative. So what one sees is that by computing the effective action in this way, you're not actually picking out dissipation. You're not picking it up. You can go one step further and compute something a little more interesting, and that is to compute the self-force in extreme mass ratio findings. So in that case, you have a small compact object orbiting a supermassive black hole. And if you compute the first order, the effective action through first order in the mass ratio, what you find is this combination of Green's function, half retarded plus half advanced. Okay, that's great. The problem is that's time symmetric, which means it describes a conservative self-force, not dissipated. Okay, so you can begin to see that sort of this approach to calculating radiative effects or dissipative effects isn't going to cut it, because all we're ever able to pick up is a conservative force. Here, these conservative forces are zero. Okay, but I want to emphasize, this is an important point. This is not a problem with the effective field theory approach. Rather, it's a problem with the underlying formulation of classical mechanics, at least the variational approach to classical mechanics. Why? Well, you can sort of see it because there's this well-known or infamous sort of mantra of classical mechanics. That is that Lagrangians and Hamiltonians don't describe dissipative systems. Okay, this is just a manifestation of that. So, more specifically, so I kind of demonstrated the shortcomings of this effective action principle. And I should have mentioned that from an effective action, if you vary that using the Hamilton's principle of extremal action, you get the equations of motion for the system. Okay? So this shortcoming then is associated with Hamilton's principle. So let me be more specific and say the following things, which may seem a bit heretical, but I've just demonstrated for you on the previous slide that in fact they're true. So the first point is this. The usual Hamilton's formulation is not generally consistent or even really applicable for initial value problems. And I'll show you why on the next slide. Second is that, as we saw through some of those examples, it's not able to account generally for dissipated systems. And thirdly, and not unrelated to these other two, is that it's not able to account essentially to describe non-equilibrium dynamics of systems, because non-equilibrium systems are typically exhibit dissipative effects and so on. They're non-stationary. Okay, so if we can't get around this, then this implies some serious shortcomings for the EFT approach if one's formulating it from an action or an effective action formulation. The reason is because, well, if we can't describe dissipative systems, then we can't describe the actual in-spiral of, say, well, you can't actually describe the radiation reaction on systems. So you wouldn't be able to get dissipation or radiation reaction for general orbits in a binary system, or for you wouldn't be able to get the self-force correctly for extreme mass ratio in spirals. Okay? Yeah?
That's your final remark. For the damped harmonic oscillator, you can write down that function.
That's right, yeah.
Exponential minus gamma t, V squared plus X squared.
So yeah, so
you differentiate, you get harmonic or delta harmonic oscillator.
That's right.
It's like cosmology. Cosmology of an expansion, you lose energy in the system. It's the same equation as a delta harmonic oscillator.
That's right. But so I think there was a paper put out a while ago, by I think his name was John Ray, and I think the Annals of Physics something or other, where he showed that. So one has to be careful with that kind of Lagrangian, because one can do a canonical transformation and get a purely conservative damped harmonic oscillator. So it has to be, you have to be a bit careful. Now it is true that you can include dissipative forces into a Lagrangian for very specific dissipative forces, but not certainly generally for, say, things involving the fifth time derivative of the quadruple moment of the binary. Okay, so I want to go through a simple example of where all three of these shortcomings manifest clearly, and I think you'll have more of a feel for that there is a problem or a shortcoming, I suppose. And the example is this. So imagine a harmonic oscillator described by little q, coupled to n harmonic oscillators labeled by big Q to the sub n. So I chose this system because I don't want to deal with field theory where there are divergences around, and I don't want anyone to get confused about counterterms and things being ill-defined and so on. So if I have a finite number of oscillators, there's no infinities. Okay, so that's the action for it. So let's integrate out the big Q variables. Okay, so that just means you solve the equations of motion that you would derive by varying S with respect to big Q. And if I impose initial conditions for Q, this is what I get, some homogeneous solution plus a retarded Green's function with a source given by the little q. Okay, so the effective action then is obtained by simply plugging that back in, just plugging the solution back into the action, and I get this for the action. So notice there's the retarded Green's function. Don't worry about the subscripts and all that stuff. I just want you to notice the form. So there's a Q of t retarded Green's function, Q of t prime. Now the retarded Green's function is not a symmetric Green's function in time. Since there's two integrals of t and t prime, and a Q of t and a Q of t prime, I can always do a change of variables and write it in a more symmetric form. Because after all, it's only the part that's symmetric in T minus T prime that'll contribute to the integral. So if I do that, I get exactly half your target plus half advance. Okay? Which is, well, so then when I, right, so now I have the effective action in terms of this half retarded, half advance. Again, only the time symmetric piece of retarded Green's function is going to couple to the keys. Okay? So now let's take the effective action and vary it with respect to little q to get the equation's motion. Well, you get this. Something which involves the advanced Green's function forcing the little q. Okay? So this means that little q does not, as from this equation, does not evolve causally in time because of this advanced Green's function. Furthermore, if you try to solve it, you can't solve it by specifying initial data for Q because there's information from the future of, that one needs to fix for the value of Q. And thirdly,
if you look at the other integral that has only the retarded,
yeah, you still just get this.
The same. There's no breaking up posture, right?
Well, you would think that the because the retarded Green's function goes like theta t minus t prime, you would think that it looks causal. But the problem is that when you vary with respect to little q, you also have to vary this guy. So varying with respect to this just gives you g retarded q, which is a causal force. Varying with respect to this guy gives you this, which is not causal. So that's where that advanced Green's function. Okay, so again, we encounter this half-retarded plus half-advanced Green's function, which is indicative of, well, there being no dissipation precisely because it's time-symmetric. It describes only conservative interactions. So this is kind of a simple system where all three of these things, the acausality, the conservative interactions and forces, and the inconsistency with initial data, all kind of manifest.
It's Feynman-Mirov. It's a Feynman-Mirov theory.
Hamilton's principle. So if you vary that effective action, you get acausal forces, you get an equation of motion that can't be solved with initial data only, and and it only describes conservative systems. Okay, so not to insult everyone's intelligence, but just so we're on the same page. So Hamilton's principle of extreme on action, which is what I've used up to now to demonstrate this, space has essentially tries to find a solution to the following problem. So imagine that we have two time slices, t equals ti the initial time and t equals tf the final time. Okay? And the problem is this, stated very precisely. Find the path q of t passing through the given values qi at the initial time and qf at the final time that extremizes the value of the action. So one path might be this one, another path might be the one on the left, but in general there's going to exist some preferred path, the extremal path, that satisfies the Euler-Lagrangian equations if and only if that solution passes through the values qi and qf at those respective times. Okay, so therein lies the problem. Namely, this is appropriate for boundary conditions in time, not for initial conditions. Okay, there's no mention of an initial velocity, no preferred direction of the initial time slice, and so on. So if we recall the harmonic oscillator example, we got this half retarded plus half advance. And if we recall, just as an example from Stern-Liouville theory, this kind of symmetric Green's function, say half retarded plus a half advance, is indicative of a conservative dynamics. But this time symmetric Green's function is also the one appropriate for boundary value problems. It's just the Stern-Liouville theory. So there's kind of this deep connection between conservative dynamics, boundary conditions, and symmetric Green's functions. Okay, so I guess the question then is, well, how does one go about fixing this to accommodate say, initial conditions. Well, first, does everyone understand that there's a shortcoming? I hope. Okay, so let's try to fix the variational principle, or Hamilton's principle. So let's specify some initial data, qi, and its derivative. Yeah?
So the shortcoming arises because you choose to integrate out one of the degrees of freedom and replace that into the action to get a new action for the remaining degrees of freedom. But there's no problem if you actually carry out the variation for all the degrees of freedom and then deal with the equations of motion from which you can impose whatever initial conditions.
That's right, yeah.
So it's a subtle shortcoming.
That's right.
Really there, but only there if you choose to implement it in a very specific way.
That's right, yeah. And at least in within some effective field theories, it's kind of necessary to go through the variational thing first. So it's important to have the right boundary conditions on, I would say. But yes, so you could go through, just get the equations of motion and just be done with it if you want.
But so doesn't this mean also that you're using this effective action is not warranted at all because you're not getting the right equations of motion?
Yeah, right.
So
you will get the right equations of motion for conservative systems. So for a binary, if you're looking at conservative corrections to the post-Newtonian potential, then
Stick with your simple example. Now you have a bunch of harmonic oscillators. You're saying integrating out n minus one of them, and plugging the result back into the action does not give me the correct effective action.
That's right.
I mean, the action is sympathetic to start with. I mean, the linear.
Isn't that too strong of a statement? It depends. It depends what observables you look at. Some observables are perfectly well behaved in that direction.
Static properties.
Furthermore, couldn't you just add boundary terms to the effective action and fix them to get the right dynamics? That's matching, right?
Yeah.
That's fixed times, right?
That
you can do that when there's boundaries.
I don't know.
Spatial boundaries, so why don't you do it?
So for linear theories, that might be possible. For nonlinear, I don't know how that goes.
Been done for nonlinear theories, at least when there's spatial boundaries, not time boundaries.
Okay.
It seems like it would also work at the initial boundary.
Yeah.
Well, the variation of the action gives you the boundary conditions. That's okay. What boundary terms are.
Right.
But then you won't have the final time.
Well, okay.
Yeah. So what I'm talking about may be related to what you're thinking or what you're seeing.
Right.
Maybe you can tell me.
Right.
But thanks. Okay, so a naive approach to solve this might be to specify some initial data and then look at all the paths that have that value and that derivative and just send them up and then try to find some path that extremizes the action. Okay, so let's parameterize these paths as q of t0 plus epsilon a to t. So a to t measures, so q of t0, let's say, is the stationary path and epsilon is, say, some small number and eta is some arbitrary function that vanishes at least. Now, the variation of the action gives you something which looks an awful lot like the integral of this arbitrary function with the Euler-Lagrange equations. But then you get this boundary term. So at the initial time, because the variation is fixed, there's no contribution there, but nothing is fixed at the final time. So when you compute the Euler, so when you find the stationary point, what you find is that you get the Euler-Lagrange equations plus some contribution. Essentially some forcing term, if you like, at the very final time that arises from a non-zero conjugate momentum. So we could say, well, let's just make sure the conjugate momentum is zero at the final time, but if you have initial data, there's no reason why that should be the case. In general, it's not going to be. Okay. So this whole kind of approach just fails for initial data. So one has to think of something maybe slightly more different. And so that's what I'll talk about for the next few slides, okay? Okay, so the idea to fix this, to fix the shortcomings that I mentioned earlier, is instead of considering one path, to consider two. And I'll consider two paths such that they have vanishing displacements, so their eta, if you like, vanishes at the initial time. And also that at least at the final time, that the coordinates and conjugate momenta of both of these paths are equal. So there's a kind of continuity condition at the final time. Now this may look strange, because after all, we want initial data. We don't want to specify something physical at the final time, because we want to evolve to the final time. OK, so if we want to vary the action, then we need to change both paths. And the point I want to emphasize is that I don't care what the value is at the final time, just that there is a value, okay? Which is why I'm not fixing the variation at the final time.
You mean that you're fixing the location at the beginning?
At the beginning.
You fix the location and you require that the moment to be.
Yeah, that's right, for both paths, yeah. And then in principle, and I'll show you that there exists some set of paths, some pair of paths that extremizes the action, some preferred set. Once we've found the paths that vary, or that extremize the action, then we'll set both paths equal to the physical one. Okay. So for this extremal case, neither path is big as physical, because we don't have two paths going around in time, right? Just have one. So we need to identify them. And I'll call this the physical limit. OK, so this may look a little dubious, but just hang on for a few minutes. OK, so in the usual approach, the action is defined as the line integral of the Lagrangian of the system. So here, I'll define a new action, which is simply the line integral of the Lagrangian for each path. And because of the continuity condition, the integral of the first path goes from ti to tf, and then back from tf to ti along the second path. OK? Yeah. So you can swap the limits of integration and get a minus sign. Thanks, Andy. Relative to the first term. And this defines essentially a new Lagrangian. Essentially the Lagrangian for the first path minus the Lagrangian of the second one. So one's comparing the line integrals of the first path minus the line integral of the second path. And that's the quantity we're going to extremize. Okay, so let's extremize it. So first, it turns out to be convenient to make, if you like, a canonical transformation to plus minus variables. So plus here is merely just the average of the two paths, and minus is just the difference. And you can compute their corresponding conjugate momenta. So p plus is just the derivative of our new Lagrangian with respect to q dot minus, and vice versa for the p minus. And the virtual paths are defined similarly as before. So have some extremal one and displace it by eta plus and eta minus for each plus and minus variable. Okay, so then the variation of the new action is, well, you essentially have two copies of what we've had before. One which involves something that looks like the Euler-Lagrange equation for relative to a plus variable, plus displacements, and Euler-Lagrange equation for relative to the minus displacements, plus some boundary term. OK, so the name of the game, then, is to try to get rid of this boundary term. Maybe that's what you're thinking.
Yeah.
OK, so what are the conditions that we need? Well, I stated earlier that we're going to demand first that the displacements vanish at the initial time. And this implies that eta 1 and eta 2 at the initial time are 0. And so therefore, eta plus and eta minus at the initial time are 0. Secondly, I also demanded continuity of the coordinates at the final time. So while their values may not be fixed, whatever they are, they're equal to each other. So eta 2 at tf is equal to eta 1 at tf, which means that eta minus at the final time is 0. Yeah?
Sorry, this may be supporting the punchline, but is this just sort of the classical version of Meehan informals?
Yes, that's right. So you can derive, yeah, oh, there's a slide on that, but you can derive this from the classical limit of the corresponding quantum theories in the NN formulation. However, within a purely classical framework, there shouldn't be a need to refer to NN or CTP or whatever.
Yeah.
You don't need path integrals to describe the motion of the charge, for example.
Yeah.
And lastly, continuity of the conjugate momenta at the final time implies that P minus at the final time is 0. So these taken together mean that our boundary term from the variation is in fact 0. And we can now isolate what essentially corresponds to the Euler-Lagrange equations. for the plus and minus variables. Okay. So the point I want to get across is that by doubling the number of paths and imposing these boundary conditions for our q plus and q minus variables, that we get two copies of the Euler-Grange equations, one for the plus variable and one for the minus variable. And lastly, our last step is to identify the two physical paths with the physical, to identify the two unphysical paths with the physical one, which means that q1 equals q2 equals 2 q, q is our physical one, so that q minus goes to 0 and q plus goes to q. Okay.
We need the last step because isn't that guaranteed from the equations of motion and the fact that you are imposing these boundary conditions?
No.
No?
No, not quite. For source-free motion, it turns out to be true. For source motion, it's not. One has to put the physical limit out, right? I'll show you an example.
But so far, there's no source.
That's right, that's right. Okay, right. So this gives you the Euler-Lagrange equations consistent with initial value, initial conditions.
But you didn't keep the initial conditions yet, but you need to specify the velocity.
That's right. Well, so we gave that surreptitiously here. So there's an, maybe here. Nope. Well, this arrow is to represent the initial velocity.
Well,
but it doesn't enter.
In your definition of the problem, you said you're constraining the variation. You're fixing only the locations of the two guys.
Sorry. I should. Yeah. So I'm fixing the location, but also each of these blue lines for the first path has an equal tangent. Their tangent vectors, if you like, are equal to the initial velocity.
You're fixing also both velocities.
Yeah. Just the one. Just the one velocity here. So here the velocities at the initial time or whatever. It doesn't matter. All I require is that the variation is zero. Here I'm fixing the initial values of the first path. And this actually leads to a slight ambiguity, because I could associate the second path with the initial data. Okay. Or I could associate the initial data with the plus path, the average path. And in fact, I'll make this a convention that I'll do this, precisely because in the physical limit, q plus goes to q, and q is the physical thing that actually carries the initial conditions. These paths 1 and 2 are unphysical. They don't mean anything. You can't measure the paths 1 and 2. It's only the physical path that you can make statements about. So the 1 and 2 paths, if you like, I can associate with them however I want to the initial data. Okay, right. So there's a. So you can go through and do this for every system you encounter, or you can realize that there's a slight shortcut to deriving the equation's motion in this formalism. And the first is to notice that in the physical limit, q minus goes to 0 and q plus goes to q. So if I look at the Euler-Lagrange equation that involves the d lambda dq dot plus, this is really the equation for the minus variable, because this is the p minus, the conjugate momentum of q, essentially of q plus. Q minus, really. Okay, and in the physical limit, P minus goes to 0, so the content of this equation just goes away. Whereas for the other Euler-Lagrange equation, it's for D plus by DT, and that's the one that contains the physical content. In particular, all one needs to do, well, if you remember from one of the previous slides, this equation, the Euler-Grange equation involving the derivatives with respect to q minus was multiplied by an eta minus. So all you need to do is to take variations of the action with respect to the minus variable and then set that equal to 0. Which means that only terms in this new action that are linear in the q minus variable, are the ones that contribute to forces, to physical forces. So in other words, if there's a q minus squared or cubed term in the new action, it doesn't matter. It doesn't contribute to the equations of motion. Okay, so I'll probably use this occasionally throughout. Okay, so that was maybe a bit abstract. So let's go through a little example and just look at a simple harmonic oscillator. Okay, so this is definitely overkill for the system, but I just want to emphasize what's going on here. Yeah. So consider a unit, a harmonic oscillator with mass equal to 1. So this is the Lagrangian, and the new Lagrangian that I'm proposing is, for initial value problems, is L of Q1 minus L of Q2. Okay, so the equations of motion simply just follow by the Euler-Lagrange equations for each respective variable, which are just the harmonic oscillator equations for Q plus and Q minus. Okay, and they have general solutions given by the usual cosine and sines. Okay, now we have boundary conditions on Q minus because of trying to impose that our boundary terms from the variation go to 0. So in particular, the continuity of the two pads at the final time implies that Q minus equals 0, and the continuity of momentum implies that P minus goes to 0, or equivalently in the system that Q dot minus is 0 at the final time. So this immediately specifies the solution for Q minus. It's 0. Okay. And now our initial conditions for Q plus are precisely the physical ones. So Q plus at the initial time is just QI, and its derivative is just VI. And that just gives us our regular solution that in the physical limit, which is trivially done here, just as a solution, manifests as the real solution that satisfies initial data. OK, so how about something slightly more interesting? So something that involves forced harmonic oscillator. I just said slightly more interesting. So let's add an external driving force. Now, our Lagrangian is the harmonic oscillator plus this Q times F. Okay, because in the usual formulism, you would get the usual harmonic oscillator and varying with respect to Q then gives you it driven by the force. Now, since we're doubling the number of paths in our problem, we ought to also double the forces in our problem. So we have an F1 and F2. F1 sources Q1 and F2 sources Q2. Okay, and at the end, we'll identify F1 and F2 with the physical force that we're actually applying to the system. So this implies the new Lagrangian to be in the plus minus variables, something given like this. Now the equations of motion are, again, just the Euler-Lagrange equations for the plus minus variables, which is just gives you the harmonic oscillator, the forced harmonic oscillator equations for the plus minus variables. And our final conditions on Q minus and P minus due to continuity implies that Q minus is the advanced, is essentially sourced by advanced, well, is given by the advanced Green's function times F minus. Okay. And it's the advanced Green's function because this, our boundary data, our data requires that the minus variable be specified at the final time, hence the advanced. And also, our plus variable satisfies the physical data and gives, well, what we saw before, plus something that is retardedly evolved, okay, and convoluted with F plus. So in the physical limit, if we identify F1 and F2, then F minus just goes to 0, and Q minus goes to 0, and then Q plus just goes to what we had nominally expect, okay? So in other words, let me talk about the plus minus variables. This, yeah.
One and F2 with each other, then set F minus 0 or something.
I think it depends on what you want to do. So for an open system where you integrate out, say, an electromagnetic field, you want to look at the charge motion coupled to it, then it becomes important to keep the minus variable so that all the variations are done consistently. For a system like this, where essentially flows up to an external force, it's not relevant, I would say. But for an open system, it needs to be done consistently. If you set it to 0, it turns you won't get the right effective action.
So it's an
analytical
condition.
So the plus and minus variables kind of have a natural or a physical interpretation. So from the examples that I showed you, it turns out to be more generally true that the plus variable evolves forward in time. It's the thing that actually solves the initial data. As you saw in the forced oscillator example, it has a retarded Green's function. Whereas the minus variable evolves backward in time. Okay, that may seem a bit odd. Why is there something that's evolving backward in time, contributing to our dynamics? Well, the point is that the Q minus variable for source-free dynamics always vanishes. So it never contributes anything to the dynamics. Whereas if there is some force in the problem, it still always vanishes. So there's never any contribution from this advanced piece, if you like, okay, in the physical limit. Whereas the plus variable is the one, since it corresponds to the physical variable, does correspond to the actual retarded evolution in time. Now, what about the one and two variables? Well, the things we actually started off initially with. Well, there's really no clear interpretation of them, because for the forced harmonic oscillator example, Q1 looks like something that involves half retarded plus a half advanced, so the conservative symmetric Green's function, times F1, plus something which is essentially the dissipated Green's function, times F2. I don't know what that means. So, and likewise with Q2. So it doesn't seem to have any clear interpretation, which is why the plus and minus variables are kind of some preferred natural set of variables for these problems, I think.
But for practical applications, sometimes you get to use one and two applications, right?
I haven't found it to be so.
And you want to use the free gravity vertex to just get out of the standard in our function. That's the same for the one and two variables, but for the plus and minus variables.
Yeah, well, in practice, I found plus and minus to be a lot easier to work with. I think it's just experience, but I think precisely because it doesn't have that kind of natural physical correspondence.
You have field negative energy, take time of Gauss field. Negative energy, you have a negative Lagrangian, you have negative energy. So this means that your two field has negative energy, the other is positive energy. So you have an instability. So as long as you have not taken the limit with a physical field, you have instabilities in your system.
Right, so if we have a new Lagrangian, if we have a Lagrangian, then we can always construct a Hamiltonian. So I think I've showed by example that this Lagrangian can describe, I won't get to that. So let's just try to construct a Hamiltonian based off of this Lagrangian. So the conjugate momentum of P1 is related in the usual way. And P2 is related by a minus sign, precisely because lambda involves Q2 via minus L of Q2. Okay. So this means that, well, since you have conjugate momenta, you can do the Legendre transformation of each Lagrangian, take their difference, and this gives you a new Hamiltonian. I don't know why I chose A. I guess it's what the word Hamiltonian sounds like when someone from Liverpool says it. But that's, I don't know why A. But the point is that this new Hamiltonian is just P1, Q1 dot minus P2, Q2 dot minus lambda. And there's some interesting thing here, some kind of hint of internal structure for the path variables. Namely, you can sort of define a 2D Minkowski metric, okay, given by 1, 0, 0, minus 1. And you can rewrite the Hamiltonian in this form, where A and B are go from 1 to 2. And so in this kind of notation, it's very compact and still retains the sort of usual form that you might expect from the usual Hamiltonian, usual Legendre transformation. And in fact, this metric actually kind of behaves like a real metric in the sense that if you make a diffeomorphism of our Q variables, Q1 and Q2, to some Q prime 1 and Q prime 2, then in fact the derivatives and the momenta and this metric transform just like some tensors. So that this quantity involved in the Legendre transform remains invariant under the diffeomorphism. So I don't know what this means yet. I don't know if it means anything, because there are some variables where such a metric is not so easily defined. I'll say that. I'll just leave it there. So we could check this, and in the plus minus, we could do this Legendre transformation in the plus minus variables, and you'd find that it looks like this, where we can define a new metric, which is just 0, 1, 1, 0. It looks like the metric of kind of 2D flat spacetime in null coordinates. And again, there's this form that we have. So there's almost a kind of covariance, if you will, of this Legendre transformation for the Hamiltonian. Lastly, since there's a Hamiltonian, you can show that there are Hamilton's equations where the Poisson brackets are given by something like this. And essentially what you see is that the thing I want to point out is that these indices, A, for the one and two paths, look almost as if they're kind of like indices of some internal symmetry. I'm not going to say that's actually true, but it looks as if that could be the case. Okay. We're going on time. Okay, so open systems. So many effective field theories describe open systems, such as an extended charge distribution, emitting electromagnetic radiation, gravitational waves emitted by the inspiral compact binary, etc., viscous fluid flow. So it'd be nice to use this effective action principle to essentially describe open systems. Okay, so we need to make sure that if we use our, like I showed earlier with the harmonic oscillator example, that if we use the usual principle, that we won't get the right answers for the effective action. So let's try to look at the same problem again, but with the new Hamilton's principle. Okay, so let's look at our n harmonic oscillators coupled to little q. And we first define our Lagrangian by doubling the number of paths and taking the difference of the Lagrangian over each path. And you can integrate out in the same way, the variable big Q. And you get that Q plus goes like a retarded Green function and Q minus like an advanced Green function. So then the effective action looks something like this. And I'll just write it out. If you write out the solution, you get the beast that couples to the homogeneous term, plus this kind of term that looks like QA, GAV, QB. I've written it this way because it's compact and it makes use of that sort of index notation. And at least in the plus minus basis, this matrix of propagators is just the advanced and retarded Green's function. Okay? So if you vary this now.
Let's put a classical limit.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of classical. Yeah, I don't do bonding. So if you take this effective action and simply vary it with respect to Q minus and set that variation equal to zero, this is what you get. And then take the physical limit, I should say. You get exactly the harmonic oscillator coupled to something that's now causally evolving, with the causally evolving force. Okay? And if you massage this a little bit, you can rewrite it in terms of this. So these terms in red are things that come from the big Qs. So there's a frequency shift, there's a history-dependent dissipation term, gamma Q dot, and there's this external forcing term. So in this example, provided you do the variational principle right, you get some causal dynamics, which you can specify entirely by initial data. You find a history-dependent dissipation term describing, if you will, the non-Markovian evolution of the system, which, at least in the Markovian dynamic limit, just reduces down to the force of the damped harmonic oscillator. Okay. So it's 250. I haven't gotten to the and applications of EFT. I don't know if you want me to keep going on or.
So by the Markovian limit, you mean when gamma becomes a delta function?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I think it essentially means that the frequencies are higher.
Excuse me?
I think it pretty much corresponds to the omegas, the frequencies of the Q oscillators becoming very large.
Yeah.
Okay, so. Oh yeah, right, the slide on quantum theory. So this new action principle that arises from this variation formulation turns out to be the classical limit of what's the so-called in-in or close-time path formulation of quantum theory. And this is merely just an initial value formulation of the path integral quantization. So this was originally developed in the 60s by Schwinger and added on to by various other people. And it has a rather long history. Schwinger was actually introduced this in the context of harmonic oscillators and quantum mechanics. And then Feynman, I think, did it for fields. Okay, so the generating functional in the in-in approach is given by this path integral over q1 and q2, this action s of q1 minus s of q2, and then two currents that couple the q's. So these j's allow you to compute various correlation functions by just taking derivatives of z. Now, if you take the classical limit of this, what you find is that, well, the stationary phase is given by s of q minus s of q1 minus s of q2 plus this current term plus corrections of order h bar. And you see that this s of q1 minus s of q2 is exactly the action that we saw earlier. Now, you could flip this around and say, well, what if I start with the action we had earlier and quantize that in a path integral? Well, you get exactly the in-in generating functional. Okay. So the thing I want to emphasize is that this new action, s of q1 minus s of q1 q2, in some sense really is the appropriate action for initial value problems. It's the one that corresponds to the classical limit of any initial value formulation in quantum theory. And it's the one that seems consistent with initial data when just doing a usual, when doing a variational calculation. Okay, so just a summary of Hamilton's principle for initial value problems. So first, the usual formulation sort of has these shortcomings that I mentioned earlier. It cannot incorporate generally dissipation or describe accurately or correctly open systems. Secondly, this new formulation fixes these, essentially via a variational calculus for initial value problems. Okay, and it's related to quantum theory via a classical limit. And it's also appropriate for describing open systems in EMT. So I suggest that the new mantra of classical mechanics should be that this new Lagrangian Hamiltonian, and of course if you have these, you can always build a routine, can be constructed and applied to general dissipative systems. Okay, so the statement Hamiltonians don't describe dissipative systems is not the correct statement if you're doing the right variational principle. Okay, no, I don't know how much time I have. 4 minutes. Okay, let's try to do this. Okay, so just a quick example, 4 minute example. So imagine that we have a motion, we're considering the accelerated motion of an extended charge distribution. And because it's accelerated, it's being operated on by external forces, it emits radiation, and that radiation back reacts as a radiation reaction. Now, when the size of this charge is much smaller than the wavelength, the charge looks almost point-like, and you can use an effective field theory description to describe its motion. So, the FT for this system is, first let's identify the relevant degrees of freedom and symmetries. They are obviously the world line of the particle and the field. And the symmetries that correspond that come with these variables are simply Lorentz invariants, gauge invariants, and reparameterization invariants of the world line. Okay, step two, write the most general action consistent with the symmetries. Well, here in black is sort of the usual point particle action of a charge coupled to an electromagnetic field. And these terms in red are all the terms consistent with the symmetries. In particular, this term here turns out to describe an acceleration-induced dipole moment that couples to the electric and magnetic fields. This term describes essentially a susceptibility of the charge distribution. Same with that one. And you can power count these factors, these coefficients, and show that they scale as E, the charge on the body, times R squared, and that these CE and CM go like R cubed. In particular, you see that these coefficients are independent of the charge, so they would appear even for a neutral body. And this CD does depend on the charge, so it would vanish from a neutral body.
Why isn't the CD term zero by field theory definitions?
Why is it?
Oh, it's A, sorry. Never mind.
Okay.
My bad.
And the one interesting thing that Ira and Adam, I wasn't on the paper by this point, found was that there were no terms that scale linearly in the size of the body, which was actually a new result in the fourth publication.
It's important to consider, right?
Yeah, that's right. We, outside of all other external influences, it's spherical, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And, okay, so step three, you could match to a specific theory or a model or some data, but we essentially looked up a paper by Marengo and Koja, and I think we doubled their citation level by doing this, that that you can find that at least for a perfectly conducting sphere of charge, CD is 1/10 of the CR squared, whereas for a spherical shell of charge, so a solid sphere, it's just 1/6. So the number changes depending on what model you're looking at. And lastly, let's compute stuff. And in particular, let's compute the radiation reaction force due to the finite size of the charge distribution. So using what we learned in the first 59 minutes of the talk, the action is, well, first we double the degrees of freedom and take the difference of the action of Lagrangian. And it looks like this. Okay, I've truncated it here. Where the J is essentially just the charge current and sigma is this acceleration-induced dipole moment. In the compact notation, where we introduce this metric, well, it looks a lot more compact. It looks just like, say, well, this term looks a lot like what the F squared term from QCD, for example, where this A acts as the charge color index. It's a similarity. Okay. Now, you can integrate out the vector field using Feynman diagrams, and I think Barak is going to talk about that, something like this later, I hope, maybe, about how this is done, maybe. Anyway, one can associate lines with propagators with Green's functions, and one can associate vertices on world lines with essentially derivatives of the action. And the thing I want to point out is that these vertices and the Green's function carry the labels A and B, which label the path 1 and 2. Or plus and minus. So in terms of the Feynman diagrams, when we integrate out the electromagnetic field, we get an effective action given by these two kind of sunset diagrams. One describes the point charge interaction with the cell, and the other describes the point charge interaction with the acceleration-induced dipole moment. Now this diagram for the leading order charge-charge interaction, it's a simple computation, and you can show that in the plus minus variables, it looks like z minus times this expression called a plus dot. And I've ignored the z minus squared terms because, again, these don't contribute to the actual physical force. It's only the terms linear in the variable in the minus variable. So then if we take the derivative with respect to z minus and take the physical limit, this gives exactly the Abraham-Lorentz-Dirac radiation reaction force. Okay. Again, this is from an action principle. We've described some dissipated force. So I'm going to make this clear. So if we compare to the usual, the effective action we would get from the usual Hamilton's principle, we would get z alpha a dot. So you see a couple things wrong. One, this factor 8 is not 6. Two, there's only an a dot, not a u alpha u beta a dot. Sorry. And three, this term is 0 anyway, so it doesn't matter. Now, when we calculate the next diagram, the coupling of the charge, and this will be the last thing, the coupling of the charge to the acceleration-induced dipole moment, and get some answer, which is essentially is a new result. And it turns out, I'm not going to talk about this, that this the power that comes from this acceleration-induced dipole moment, the power and radiation, may actually have observable consequences. Well, maybe technical, I should say. Well, and that's that. So let me end there. Did you want to see that? So see Raphael's talk for issues regarding about how to include degrees of freedom accounting for dissipation in EFT, and where this may be applicable, very applicable to the hydrodynamics effect field theory. So see Alberto Nicholas's Wednesday, I think. So the take-home points, I think, are these. Most EFTs rely on building an action, and thus on Hamilton's principle, especially for open systems. The usual approach has some shortcomings, and I think we fixed them. And I think if you take these two things together, it really provides quite a general, powerful framework to study in spirals, viscous fluid flow, whatever you want. Well, we're in effective field theories. And I'll emphasize that this approach has been utilized in several applications already. For one specific application that you'll see in this workshop, we see Bob Bonstrani's talk on the 4 p.m. tail contribution potential. And I'll mention that it's also been recently applied to nonlinear perturbation theory, and it works there even. Okay, so I'll just leave it at that. Let you guess.
Someone in the audience made a comment about adding boundary terms. Could you give me one or two points how to do that? Point to literature?
Should I do it? How do I?
Or anybody who knows something about it, I don't.
I don't know what context you're talking about. So
I mean, there are terms that are allowed by the symmetries of the low energy effective action, so they belong there, right? And then you adjust the coefficients by matching the usual way as it reproduces the short distance physics. So there are terms that are allowed, right? If you have an initial final value system like you do, then there are terms in the action that are not time integrals of a Lagrangian, they're just terms, right? Depending on the fields at those values. And when you vary the full system and set that equal to zero, that will give you corrections to Hamilton's principle.
Right, But I guess it's slightly different because here I'm not adding the second path or anything to...
I don't know about it in the context of
the time interval.
Of going back in time, this thing that you're doing.
Yeah.
But I'm just reasoning by direct analogy with field theories, where there are boundaries, where even if the terms are not there classically, quantum corrections can induce terms
right.
of
boundaries. Or even like with a field interacting with a mirror or partially reflected.
Yeah, something like that. But just the fact that the boundary is there and you can write down terms that are allowed by the symmetries, I think that means that, well, you've got to write them down. That's part of the effect of field theory dogma. Right? So that's all I can say about that.
Thanks.
Yeah. You explained that in order to take into account the dissipative effects in the right way, you have to use this in informalism, right? So now we know that in informalism is completely equivalent to in out formalism in the adiabatic regime. Just a statement. So where in your story the adiabaticity breaks down?
Oh, self-force, for example, in extreme mass ratio in spirals. So there are generic, these are sources of gravitational waves for LISA, whatever incarnation states. And in that case, the orbits are generically perturbations of Kerr geodesics, if you will.
So it means that omega dot over omega square is not small parameter.
Well, I should continue. So for Kerr, if you imagine a Kerr geodesic, it exhibits, so it has it can be described by three frequencies. And if two of these frequencies become commensurate, then you get a resonance in the orbit. And this resonance is a non-adiabatic regime.
But I think you mentioned also that in post-Newtonian regime, you also at some point get...
Imagine you have just two bodies coming in. That's not really an adiabatic regime, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So what's the relation between this new approach and the composite operator technique of IRA and Walter to deal with dissipative effects?
So I think they're to be used in combination. So from what I understand of their work, those are just extra degrees of freedom to allow to describe absorption. So for example, dissipation, whatever, to describe it within the effective degree. So to describe absorption or dissipation, you need to have some extra number of degrees of freedom so that you can dump the energy into it and heat it up and do whatever you want. However, the time evolution of those degrees of freedom is what I think this thing is useful for.
In terms of terminology, that's what I was... So I usually think of an open system as one where you don't track some degrees of freedom. But if I integrate out a field, that Hamiltonian is hermitian and it's unitary. And so that's unitary evolution, if I think quantum mechanically.
Yeah.
So, I would consider an open system one where you don't track some degrees of freedom. And now, or dissipation would also be that. But clearly, this formalism, so the question is when do you need this formalism? And at least the way I use the term open, I'm not sure I would say it's when you need an open system. I mean, if you're looking at time evolution, then you need, because I would consider radiation reaction, maybe I'm using the term wrongly, but I would consider that an open system.
Yeah, I would too,
I wouldn't.
Oh, really?
I think I would use the term differently than you do.
Oh, because I would, because it's losing energy. So in terms of the
but
world...
But it's not, because the energy is in the electromagnetic field. In other words, an open system, I would say, should have some degrees of freedom which you're not tracking. Now, just because you integrate over them doesn't mean you're not including all their effects. I mean, I know I'm including all the effects of the electromagnetic radiation. So I would not call that an open system.
I think it's a matter of distinction. So certainly the electromagnetic field and the world line system, that thing, the couple is closed.
Right.
But if I integrate out the field and only concentrate on world line degrees of freedom,
No, but all the information about the field is still there. Right?
Yeah, that's right. Or you could parameterize them and so on and treat
so
the world line.
I would call it open
precisely because it's losing energy.
Beyond terminology, sorry. So to follow up on my question. So would you use this formalism just to track, for instance, radiation reaction effects, and use the other formalism to track of absorption by the black hole or by the
system? Yeah.
That's how
I would use it.
Okay.
Sorry, but isn't this formalism needs to know what is the physics that is responsible for removing the energy, the absorption, like in this case radiation? Well, if you use a composite operator, you are not assuming anything about the physics, and you're just taking a correlation function that is the minimum information. In principle, there could be two systems which have the same correlation function, that the two-point function, let's say, for that process, and would give the same physics. Seems to me that in the composite operator setup, you're not assuming anything about the physics.
Right.
You're coming to.
Here
you can really do it if you have the Lagrangian for the other system, and then it showed how to effectively integrate out. But
you're
not really imagining here, right? We have in the composite operator, because you need to imagine there's some information you cannot give.
That's yes and no. So for the binary,
you can compute.
You can do the integral. Well,
except for the finite size. Device.
For the binary and spiral, right, you can always do the matching and the radiation.
For example, the Arakan, the Arakan force, but you can get exactly, you don't need to do any matching.
That's right,
Whereas for dissipation, for the gamma coefficient, you still need to do the matching, but you know what you do.
That's
right.
That's
okay, so thank you, Chad.